This is the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. One of the most interesting things about World War II is that we are continuing to learn new things about events, both during the war and immediately after the war, things we did not know, and things that are coming to light due in part to the opening of archives in different parts of Eastern Europe and Central Europe and even here in the United States. Today, we're going to have, I think, a great eye-opening experience coming to know of one of the great events of World War II that no one knew about at the time who wasn't directly involved, and that's the rescue of 500 stranded, downed American airmen, pilots, and aircrew from Yugoslavia in the middle of World War II. 500. It's an incredible story. It's one that is now the subject of the book, The Forgotten 500, by Gregory Freeman. He's going to be with us in just a few moments, and it's just a reminder to us that some absolutely amazing, courageous, and heroic things took place in that conflict that we didn't even know about and have not known about until just lately. The book is The Forgotten 500 by Gregory Freeman. We're going to have the author in just a moment. First, a review of some issues in the news. As you know, and we've discussed on this program, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America just a couple of weeks ago decided that it was going to pass a resolution instructing its bishops not to bring disciplinary action against openly homosexual clergy, and in particular against clergy in open homosexual relationships, committed homosexual relationships. And we talked about the institutionalized hypocrisy in that decision because the church isn't changing its policy. Its policy precludes that. Its policy says that ministers may not be on the roster of the denomination, that is, they may not serve a church if they are not in a heterosexual relationship, but are instead in a homosexual relationship. But instead of changing the policy, which they did not have either the courage nor the numbers to do, instead they said, let's just not bring a prosecution against those who are found to violate the policy. Now, what makes that particularly interesting is the fact that a part of the pressure that was brought on the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, that's the ELCA, when it was meeting for the church's General Assembly in Chicago, was that over 80 homosexual clergy came out of the closet in one mass movement. Now, what do you do with that? Well, if you're a liberal denomination and you've already begun compromising all these doctrines, if you do not hold to the inerrancy and infallibility of Holy Scripture, then what you have to deal with is the authority of the experience of those who present themselves and say, we're here, we're gay, we're clergy. The Christian Century is in many ways the flagship magazine of liberal Protestantism, and in the issue that just came in the last day or so, the editor of the magazine writes this: mainline Protestants have spent decades debating homosexuality. The debate is vast and complex, involving biblical interpretation, ancient history, the disputed meaning of certain Greek words, and the incomplete findings of biological and social sciences. Sometimes obscured in this protracted debate are the lives of homosexual persons who are already part of the church and indeed are already ministers of the church. So I just want you to notice what's going on in that argument, because you're likely to hear it elsewhere. In other words, these people are already homosexual, they're already in the church, they're already ministers, so just deal with it. Notice the authorities cited by the editor of the magazine. The authorities cited are the Bible, history, certain Greek words, and the findings of biological and social sciences. You know, where is Martin Luther's statement? I mean, after all, this is a Lutheran denomination. It is the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Where is the Luther statement here, where he put himself on the line and said it's by Scripture alone, not history, not debates over certain Greek words, certainly not the findings of biological and social science? It was Luther who, at the Diet of Worms, in that great moment of the Reformation, said, here I stand, I can do none other, God help me. That's a real contrast between the new policy, which is, we're going to keep our policy against homosexual clergy, but when someone's found to violate it, we're not going to enforce it. Meanwhile, the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion have been torn asunder by the issue of homosexuality, and Chicago is again a focus, as now the Episcopal Diocese of Chicago has opened its process to elect and consecrate a new bishop. And one of those who is an official candidate among the five is an openly lesbian priest, the Reverend Tracy Lind, Dean of Trinity Cathedral in Cleveland, Ohio. She is a lesbian who has a female partner. She'll be on the November 10 ballot for the next bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Chicago. This comes in the face of the fact that the Anglican Communion has called upon the American Church, the Episcopal Church, to cease and desist from any further actions of the sort. It's a sign that there just must be a fissure coming within that communion over the issue of biblical authority and homosexuality. At my website at albertmuller.com today, I posted an article entitled "An Enforced Secularism, a Threat to the Pulpit." You know, there are a lot of folks out there who say, I'm not sure we should be really involved in issues over the regulation of human sexuality and laws concerning human sexuality and anti-discrimination laws and all the rest in the public square. Just let the church be the church. Well, let me tell you the fallacy with that. The Church of England has just had to issue a statement suggesting that the current anti-discrimination policy being considered by the British Parliament would indeed compromise the freedom of the church to preach the gospel. Listen to this. This is from The Telegraph, one of London's major newspapers. Church leaders expressed fears last night that Christians could be sued under proposed new laws to protect gays from harassment. The government is proposing to introduce the laws to protect individuals from hostile or humiliating environments as part of an overhaul of discrimination legislation. But Christian lawyers and the Church of England warned that Christians could face legal action if they offended gays by expressing the traditional teaching that homosexual sex was immoral. Now, this is the reality. According to this law, a homosexual person could sue if they heard a sermon that declared homosexuality to be sinful. A church could be sued if it excluded someone from membership because they were homosexual, and this person said that they were put in a, quote, humiliating position. Schools, explicitly Christian schools, could be sued for discrimination if they hold to policies or to teachings that homosexuality is wrong or sinful. Again, reading from the Telegraph, government plans to extend the same harassment laws to religion and belief were also criticized. The church said it could lead to people objecting to religious symbols, such as crosses on hospital walls, on grounds that they were an affront to atheists. So this is the logic. Now, this law, which is also suggesting that non-harassment or anti-discrimination laws should apply to religion and belief, it means that no one can offend anyone on the basis of belief. Well, just try that. You know, every once in a while I hear that in the United States of America. I hear someone say, I ought to have the freedom never to be offended by another person's beliefs. Let me just tell you, that is not the freedom that we are guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution. We actually have a freedom to offend. Now, we don't need to be offensive for the sake of offending. We know that with the love and spirit of Christ. But the fact is that anytime you have a free exchange of ideas, someone's going to be offended. And there is no right not to be offended. I think what we see here in this Church of England statement is the recognition that there's a head-on collision when anti-discrimination laws include sexual orientation and behavioral issues, because what immediately follows is a collision when religious liberty is sacrificed on the altar of political correctness. I mean, if it is considered to be illegal and wrong for someone to feel badly if a preacher says that homosexuality is a sin, and then the preacher is cited or sued for preaching that message, then there is no religious liberty. The bottom line is that religious liberty is meaningless if the pulpit is not free to preach the word of God, if churches cannot determine their own membership, and if Christians are silenced in their Christian testimony. There is a lot in the media just over the last couple of days about what's going on in the fall television schedule, but let's just say the bottom line is it's getting racier and racier, more sexual content in particular. Next week we'll be taking a look at that. Of course, there's also a lot going on in the news right now in terms of how you deal with persons who have had sex change operations and consider themselves transgender and all the rest. One writer in the media today is talking about the fact that the Illinois State Driver's License Renewal Certificate included the question, have you changed your gender in the past year? Now, let me just ask you, rewind human history just a few years and imagine your grandparents getting a form in the mail, asking them if they've changed their gender in the last year. The nation of Canada is going to release its first census count of same-sex married couples next week. But some gay activists are not happy with the way the census has treated the question, because the question was married, single, or other. They're suggesting that the other is in itself a form of discrimination. Folks are living in interesting times. It's certainly the time for intelligent Christian conversation. When we come back, we're going to be looking at one of the unknown stories of World War II. It's going to fascinate and encourage you. We have the author of The Forgotten 500, Gregory Freeman, with us. We'll be back with that discussion and your calls. I'm Albert Mobile. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. It was just about 2 years ago we had as a guest on this program Captain Robert Prince, who led that great raid to rescue the American POWs there in the Philippines at near the end of World War II. It's a great story, because what better story could there be than a successful rescue of those who are behind enemy lines? I have just read a fascinating book. It's entitled The Forgotten 500. The author is Gregory A. Freeman, and it tells a story I didn't know anything about. And that's the rescue of hundreds of American airmen who were downed in Yugoslavia as the 8th Air Force was bombing the oil fields in Romania. And the story is absolutely fascinating, both in terms of what it tells us about the war and what it tells us about the men, especially who were involved, and the men and women and those who were the citizens of Yugoslavia who risked their own lives to save these American airmen. Gregory Freeman's with me on the line today. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Tell me about how you came to know this story and came to write the book.
Well, you know, I honestly just sort of stumbled across the story originally because I'm, you know, a bit of a history buff. I'm always poking around here and there, and I'm really drawn to any tale that seems like it should have been told already but hasn't been. And this certainly fits the bill for that.
Now, part of the reason this story hasn't been told and wasn't known at the time is because the governments basically involved kept it secret.
Yeah, it's a wild story about how what should have been trumpeted as a really huge success, this amazing rescue, which was completely successful and not a life lost in the whole operation, how it all got tangled up in this very complicated World War II and post-war finagling between the Americans, the Brits, the former Yugoslav government, the new Yugoslav government, and the Russians. It all became very complicated.
Now, let me try to set out the skeletal form of the story, and then I'm going to ask you to come back in and put some flesh on these bones. Basically, you had all these pilots and air crew who were downed as their great big bombers were going down in flames as the Luftwaffe was shooting them down as they were going to and coming from Romania, trying to knock Hitler out of the oil business and to cut him off from his petroleum. And the Yugoslavian villagers welcomed them, protected them. They put up a very brave resistance. And there was an amazing Yugoslavian patriot, General Draza Mihailovic, who, along with his partisans, the Chetniks, really protected and eventually helped to rescue these American air crew. And you're talking about 500 persons.
Right.
And they flew in C-47s, those are DC-3s, into an airstrip made on the side of a mountain by hand right under the noses of the Nazis.
Right. They were surrounded by Nazis, and they had to build an airstrip, their own airstrip, with virtually no tools, a few farm implements and some bloodied hands, and that was about it. And they had to do it without the Luftwaffe planes that flew over every day realizing what they were doing.
Now, one of the things that was very moving about the book to me was the bravery of these Yugoslavians in protecting these American aircrew. Tell us a little bit about that.
It's a really touching part of the story, because these were Serbian people in the hills of the former Yugoslavia. These were people that, even under the best of circumstances, when there isn't a war raging, are living a pretty simple existence. When the Nazis took over their country and they were surrounded as they were just barely getting by. I mean, people were nearly starving. There was no food, no clothing. But when these American airmen dropped out of the sky, they were instantly embraced by the local people, protected at great risk to themselves, and given everything they could possibly be given. These peasants would feed these American airmen before they would feed themselves and their own children.
Yeah, one of the touching things I found in the book was where you described these airmen kind of woofing down the food and then realizing with a very guilty sense they were eating the only food the family had.
Right, right. And it wasn't really the airmen's fault. They'd been on the ground for a few hours. Maybe they didn't really realize the circumstances so well. And by the time they had eaten what they thought was a pretty meager meal, they realized the family was actually just serving them first and waiting to eat themselves.
You know, that is just a very touching part of this story, but it kind of comes full circle. And I love the part at the end where, and I don't know who had this idea, and you may not either, but one of these rescued airmen had the idea as they're on these C-47s, you know, getting ready to be evacuated. Several of them took off their shoes and gave them to the Serbs, and they went home with their feet in canvas bags to protect them from the cold. I thought that was another great part of the story.
Yeah, and it illustrates the mutual love that developed between these two very very different people. When they landed, the American airmen didn't really know what to expect, and they had in fact been given some bad information and told that these people were pretty hostile. But by the time they were rescued, they had bonded so deeply with these people because they saw the kind of sacrifices they were making. And yes, as they were actually leaving and they were going back to safety, a lot of them sort of together realized at the last moment, oh my God, we can leave things for these people. And they actually went to the doors of the plane, started taking off their army boots and throwing them out the door to these Serbian villagers who were, a lot of them were walking around in little felt shoes.
You know, I was really touched by what you talked about with some of these big Chetnik fighters trying to squeeze their feet into these size 8 American shoes.
Yeah, yeah.
And you could just see that. And by the way, I just thought you told the story so well by getting the big picture and those small details together. My guest today is Gregory A. Freeman. He's the author of the new book, The Forgotten 500. The subtitle is The Untold Story of the Men Who Risked All for the Greatest Rescue Mission of World War II. There's a lot to the story we're going to be talking about in just a moment, but you may want to call and ask a question. To do so, just dial 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Mr. Freeman, another part of the story that, to me, as an historian, really fascinated me, is how this is interwoven with the history of one of the most conflicted regions in the entire world.
Right.
I mean, most Americans right now, when they hear of Croats and Serbians and what we rightly describe as the former Yugoslavia, we think about the Balkans and this cauldron of ethnicities and all the rest. When we go back to World War II, let's just retrace this story a little bit because it is tied in with America as well. You have the Yugoslavs, in this case, the Serbians and all the rest, that had a regent, Prince Paul, who had basically signed on the Tripartite Pact with the Nazis.
Right.
Then you had a young king, Peter II, who defied the Nazis. And this helped fill in a gap for me, by the way, in World War II, trying to figure out why Hitler delayed his invasion of Russia, the Soviet Union, in order to have this punishing effort against the Balkans and Greece. And it was in anger against the fact that King Peter II and others had defied him. But King Peter II is the only European monarch buried in the United States of America. How did that happen?
Well, the Americans and the Yugoslavs have a very long and complicated history, and it's a lot of back and forth. Friendly one day, not so friendly the next. It's a very long, complicated history.
But King Peter is the only European monarch who died on this soil and is buried in a church in the region of Chicago, Illinois.
Right.
A lot of Americans.
Home to a great many Serbs.
A lot of Americans have no idea of that. There are twists and turns to this tale you're going to want to know about. The author is Gregory A. Freeman, the book The Forgotten 500. The discussion will continue right after this break. To call with your question, just give us a call at 877-893-8255, coast to coast and with listeners around the world. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Just earlier this summer, I recommended the book Masters of the Air, which is the great story, the magisterial account of the history of the 8th Air Force over Europe. A lot of Americans just don't realize that the only way we were really pushing back at the Nazis in the first 3 years of the war in terms of Northern Europe was by means of the 8th Air Force. So we did not have land troops, of course, in Europe in the north until D-Day in June of 1944. The real story behind today's book, The Forgotten 500 by Gregory A. Freeman, is the fact that there came to Americans the knowledge that there were hundreds of downed airmen in Yugoslavia. The threat is that they would be captured by the Germans. The promise was that they just might be rescued. Mr. Freeman, tell me, who really came up with the idea, the audacious idea of rescuing hundreds of airmen under the noses of the Nazis by flying in planes to an airfield they cut out of the side of a mountain?
Yeah, the crazy plan was developed by some folks in the OSS, which was the precursor to the CIA, of course. And these were the guys who were charged with pretty much getting things done any way they could. And it was really centered on one man, George Voinovich, who is actually the subject of the love story that's actually woven through this whole tale also. And he knew they had to go in there and pick them up, but they couldn't go in and create a big splash with, like, a whole fighter squadron and a whole fleet of planes. They knew they were going to have to do it in the most discreet way possible. And that meant sending in C-47s in small groups at night with no fighter cover. They had to pretty much sneak in, get them, and sneak back out.
Something that would be impossible today, just given the radar and other things available. But back then, it is amazing to consider what wasn't known at the time. And as I read your book, I just was reminded time and time again, I know how this story ends, but those who were living it had no real confidence they knew how this story would end. I mean, the reality is
very differently for everyone.
The reality is this was a really audacious plan. I mean, as you're telling the story here, you successfully help your reader to understand this probably shouldn't work.
Right, right. Yeah, it was called crazy when they suggested it. People in the military who had to eventually sign off on it said, okay, go ahead. It's the only thing we can think of, but we really don't expect it to work.
Now, you do tell the story of General Draza Mihailovic and his Chetnik force, and on the other side of the Serbian-Yugoslavian conflict was Josip Tito,
right.
Marshal Tito, as he became known to Americans, especially during the Cold War. Basically, the Americans and the British really got behind the wrong guy here.
They did, and it's a even all these many years later, it's a little complicated to understand why, but the answer really boils down to disinformation. Churchill and the Americans, all the Allies got some really bad information about what Tito was doing versus what Mihailovic was doing. And Tito and Mihailovic were sworn enemies. They were fighting for whatever was going to be left of Yugoslavia after the war.
And Tito was a communist, we need to make clear.
Correct. He was a communist. Mihailovic had no patience for that. And they also had very different attitudes about how to fight the Germans. Tito was willing to sacrifice as many local people as it would take for even a small operation against the Germans. But Mihailovic knew the history of Yugoslavia, and he knew that maybe wasn't the wisest choice because the Germans would retaliate with an astounding viciousness. And, you know, blowing up a bridge may not have been worth it.
Yeah, it is an amazing tale of how a very proud people defied the Nazis. And it wasn't just the forces of either Tito and Mihailovic. It was also just villagers. I mean, one of the things about the story I loved is the bravery. And I'm the father of a 15-year-old boy. And, boy, I was touched in this story to hear about these partisan insurgents. This 15-year-old boy, for instance, whom you chronicle, putting a bomb inside the coal tender of a Nazi train.
Right.
I mean, risking his life. You also tell the story about a 17-year-old fighter by the name of Nick. In fact, I put that excerpt in my article. At the end of the book, I was surprised to find out he's still alive and living in Mexico City.
Yes, he's quite a guy. He's living a nice life in Mexico.
All right. Well, we're going to come back with author Gregory Freeman to talk about his book, The Forgotten 500, and we're going to talk about what kind of lessons we should draw from this and understanding that region of the world today and the kind of bravery that was really represented by the Yugoslavians and by these American crew and the pilots who rescued them back during World War II. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back. We're discussing the book, The Forgotten 500, by Gregory A. Freeman. It is the fascinating story, the rescue of hundreds of American airmen from Yugoslavia during World War II by means of flying in C-47s, that's the equivalent to the civilian DC-3, into an airstrip that really shouldn't have worked. As a matter of fact, the first plane that tried to land couldn't, but after that, a series of planes landed, and even as these airmen have been kept alive by the Serbian people, they were rescued, a story that needs to be told, and in this book, The Forgotten 500, it is told well. Mr. Freeman, let me ask you, as you told this story, how accessible to you were some of the men who had been involved?
Well, the number of people who are actually participated is getting very small now. Only one member of the actual rescue team is surviving, Arthur Jabillian. George Voinovich, who organized it, is 93 now. There's a handful of the men who were actually rescued. They were almost to a man eager to tell their story because they have been frustrated for 60 years that the Serbian people and General Mihailovic didn't get the credit they were due.
Bill's calling from Plant City, Florida, asking a related question. Go ahead, Bill.
We are enjoying the subject today. Gentlemen, I'm a retired Air Force pilot. My question is this. Have you considered, Mr. Freeman, taking this fascinating slice of America's POW history and inputting it to the National POW Museum up in Andersonville, Georgia?
I had not considered that, but it's an excellent idea.
Well, I'm glad to have the idea aired on this program. Bill, thanks for your call. And, I will tell you, it's one of those stories that brings encouragement as you read it. I'm often asked for books that men would read, and I want to tell you, this is one of those. It's a compelling story. It's got everything. It's got military, war, courage. But I also, I have to say, Mr. Freeman, was really interested in the way you helped to connect the dots in terms of Serbian and Yugoslavian history here, the Balkan history, in terms of how all this comes together. And speaking of that, as you ended your comment just a moment ago, speaking of those who were involved, the few who are still alive, they wanted to rescue the reputation of General Draza Mihailovic, who had been so instrumental in saving them.
Yes, they felt very strongly about that. Because even though this rescue was such a success, and even though General Mihailovic and his Serbian supporters had taken such extraordinary risk on their behalf, none of that was recognized. And in fact, it was all purposely hidden from the American people for years because the State Department didn't want to risk running afoul of Tito's communist government. They felt that any recognition of what Tito's enemy, Mihailovic, had done would cause a rift between the two governments.
And when Tito gained control, he held a Stalinist show trial and had Mihailovic executed.
Yes, in very short order. And even during that, the American airmen worked valiantly to try to get the word out that he was not everything that Tito was accusing him of and that he had actually saved their lives. But Tito completely turned a deaf ear to it and executed Mihailovic pretty quickly.
Well, you know, there are a lot of things in terms of our nation's history that aren't known to us, and, you know, we don't know what we don't know, but you told us one thing we didn't know, and that is that the United States government presented to General Mihailovic posthumously its highest award given to a non-American, but it did so privately without announcing it had done so. What's going on there?
Right. It's an incredible irony. There were folks in the Pentagon who realized, including MacArthur, who realized that Mihailovich needed recognition for what he had done. And so they did get the president to approve awarding the Legion of Merit, highest honor we can award to a foreign national. But then the State Department intervened and again said, well, if we give him this award, Tito's government might be annoyed. So they officially gave Mihailovich the award, but never told anybody, put the award in a drawer at the State Department where it sat for about 40 years.
Yeah, but after that 40 years, something great happened to it. Tell us that story.
Then, through the intervention of some congressmen and the remaining airmen who knew the truth, they were able to take that award over to the former Yugoslavia and personally present it to Mihailovich's daughter. It was a long overdue recognition of what her father had done for the American people.
That's a very touching part of the story, as is, by the way, the fact that, again, you have, as you said, an interplay of the history of the United States and the former Yugoslavia here. Why are there so many Serbian Americans living in the area of Chicago?
I'm not sure I have the exact answer for that, although I know that they have settled quite a bit in Chicago, I believe Pittsburgh also, and some other communities. A very, very strong Serbian community there. And one of the great things about this is that the Serbian people actually know this story much, much more than the rest of the American people. If I talked to a group of Serbian Americans recently and told them, this is the first time I don't have to start this story at the beginning, because you actually know what General Mihailovich did for the American soldier.
If there is a moral to this tale, and I think there are probably several, I'd just like to know, what do you see as the great lesson of the Forgotten 500?
I think the real lesson of this story is all about humility and the importance of honoring the sacrifice of another. You know, when this story was hidden for so long, when the American people didn't know anything about it for 60 years, the airmen who did the rescue and the airmen who were rescued, they were not upset that they didn't get recognition. They were deeply upset that General Mihailovich and the Serbian people who helped them had gone completely unrecognized. And they held this, they held on to this in their heart for 60 years. And you talk to them today, and it still moves them to tears to think that these people did so much for them and went unrecognized.
Yeah, these Serbians literally put themselves and their families on the line, because you also give a pretty graphic depiction of the Nazi brutality against these people.
The Serbian people who helped these flyers were risking more than just their lives. I mean, we know what the Nazis did to people to punish, and they did more than just kill. If the these villagers had been caught aiding the Americans, they would have suffered a very bad fate.
The author is Gregory Freeman. The book is The Forgotten 500. Mr. Freeman, thank you for joining us today on the Albert Miller Program. All right, folks, I do want to recommend the book, and I am often asked about books to recommend from history and from current events, especially books that men might want to read. And if you've got a teenage boy or a young man or an older man at home who needs a book to read, I would really recommend this, because I would say all the way from high school up, this is the kind of book that would compel attention. I'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment. This is the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back. It was a story that needed to be told. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. It was great to have Gregory Freeman on talking about his book, The Forgotten 500. A part of what I really appreciated about this book is that it helped to fill in the gaps of some parts of the history of World War II that didn't get much attention. And, for instance, the war in the Balkans. There's something else. And at my website where I recommended the book, I recommended it along with another, and that is the book by Gregor Dallas, 1945, The Year the War Ended, although it's really subtitled The Year That Never Ended. And it's because the decisions made in 1945 are still unfolding in terms of world history, the impact on the Cold War and everything that came afterwards. But one of the fascinating things of both of these books, and this just has to be said, they're both documented down to the footnotes about the communist influence in the U.S. State Department and in the British government that led to incredible misinformation at the highest levels of policymaking in the United States. Gregor Dalas's book, 1945, is really clear about that, demonstrating how in the final year of the war, Stalin was very effective in using disinformation on both Churchill and Roosevelt, later Truman. It's another reminder to us that World War II did not end as cleanly as we like to remember. In the American memory, the way that most of us remember it, it was simply over, the boys came home, and the world went on happily ever after. Not so for so many of the people of Europe who ended up being trapped behind what Winston Churchill famously called the Iron Curtain that descended upon that continent. And even as the issue could be debated over and over again, if America could have done anything differently, if the outcome could have been anything other than what it was, the reality is that the American people really did not know at the time, nor for many, many years thereafter, what was really behind many of those decisions. But many of the people who are the heroes and heroines of the story that was told today, the story so well told in the Forgotten 500, ended up being persecuted and killed by the communists as they took over the nation that became known as Yugoslavia under Marshal Tito. You know, I think it's something just for Americans to hear that the Legion of Merit, our highest award given to a non-American, was given to a man who helped to rescue hundreds and hundreds of American airmen, but it was given privately so that we wouldn't offend a communist government to know that it had been awarded. You know, sometimes there is grace in just making sure the truth gets out. That's one of the important aspects of this story. Finally, the truth gets out. You'll be inspired by the courage. It's another reminder to us of the price that was paid for our freedom and our liberty, even as there is a dwindling number of living veterans who could tell the story from their own experience. There is not an American living today who does not live in their debt. Back with you next week for Intelligent Christian Conversation. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.